Hi, everyone. So my name is Ching. I've been in Google for 14 years as an economist. So actually, I'm really in the alphabet. So I spent 14 years consulting across the company, providing methodologies and market design, all kinds of tools for many different divisions and product teams. Since most of Google data are actually confidential, I can't really talk about it. But there's one data source, it's public, that's Google Trends. How many of you actually used Google Trends before? Wow, not many, I'm surprised. Anyway, if you don't know it, just Google it and go and find out. First, can type your name first, see how many people search for you. Anyway, so Google Trends data is actually really powerful. It's actually normalized search query counts and over the time. It's actually really updated. You can actually find out hourly sort of trends images for the last few hours. This data actually provides such a good, powerful metrics, you know, for what's going on in the world. And especially you can find out a lot what our users, our the people, what they're doing. In the past, it's just very difficult to do. I think most of the studies I've seen in social sciences are relying on survey data. And you know survey data is incredibly biased and very expensive to get. But for Google Search Trends, you can just discover this behavior pattern very quickly. This is a very good example, right? We have a daily Google Trends around the New Year time. One is actually for vodka, one is for Hanover. And so this blue line or red line. And which one do you think is Hanover, which one is vodka? Just based on the day of week patterns. It turns out that of course, people drink the weekend. That's why it peaks at the weekends. And very interesting enough, the Hanover is actually peaks on Sunday, just one day behind Saturday, because people try to recover. But interesting enough, the highest peak actually occurred around the New Year's Eve. And the next day, they wake up, they had to find the recipe. Right? Very quick, and you really know what the world is like. So, question is, how are we going to use this data source intelligently for our business? So I'm actually loosely categorized like all the analysis into three categories. So first one is consumer insights, second one predictions, and third one causal inferences. Forgive me if like I tend to use more academic terms like causal inferences. What is that about? Well, it's about does A lead to B. That's usually what I tell people. Yeah. Just a very quick example about because. Google Query Trends for entertainment. Since I think I'm in Hollywood, I would like to show you the Google Trends for movies. And here, there are two types of movies, right? The first type is what we call the white release. The second one is stage release. The white release here is a Mad Max called Fury Road. And you can tell we have two types of trends here. One is the trend you type in the Google search. The other one is to the YouTube. And it turns out these two type of trends are very closely hugging with each other. And they also go up the peaks and come down. And all these spikes and peaks actually correspond very well with different events. When the movie was first released, the trailer was first released, we see the first huge spike. And then maybe there's another trailer that came out, and there's a second spike. And right before the movie release date, we see the trends really go up. And then after a while, you know, they come down. So it's a great sort of a trend for the life cycle of a movie. But you actually see some more peaks again. I think that's actually corresponding to like available date for download and then available date for probably for streaming. And there's also a few more spikes related to Oscar if the film is actually nominated. So these trends really give you very good sort of bird's eyes view, well, the buzz and how people's interest in these films. And then you see the Danish Girl is actually have a very different pattern because the release date doesn't really correspond to the peak because the movie goes through release stages. You know, it actually climbs up and then come down a little more slowly. So once again, two types of films are a very different pattern. So what can we do with these Google query trends? Can we get more insights from them? And so I'm giving you another example here. This is the Taylor Perry's film, Medea Family Funeral. Google Trends not only show you the time series and the history itself, we also give you sort of what we call normalized search intensity. So if I type this film into Google Query Trends, you get this map. you can actually drill down to the DMA level. You can actually go down further to the city level, but unfortunately, the city level data is very sparse. You might not be able to get that much insight out of it. But for DMA level, I assume everybody here knows what DMA is. You know, we have 210 DMAs in this country, and we can actually color the search intensity for each DMA by the shade depends on how many people are searching for it. How many means percentage, not the absolute queries. But you can see right away the interest really, majority of the interest actually came from what I call the South or the sort of Bible Belt or, you know, the where there are a lot of African-American population. So the intuition actually, you know, right, this film probably is very popular in that community, and this data will show you right away that's the case. But what surprises me, actually, it quantifies that. You know, if you look at the DMA that has the most search intensity, it's almost like 4 or 5 times, or maybe even 6 times of the DMA, like, with least sort of interest. So that interest is actually very, just like spectrum is actually much wider than what I originally thought. Also, we also have all the demographic data for each DMA, so you can do a little simple math, just do a correlation calculation. So the left chart will show you the correlation with demographic variables. And of course, the first one is African American, very high correlation. And go down the list, rural and suburban, the age bracket in the sort of in 25 and 45, and a little bit of Hispanic as well. So these actually give you some idea, like, you know, what kind of population are really interested in this film, just by doing the little bit of study using the Google geo variance search trends. And we not only do we have the demographic data for each DMA, we also have what we call search interests mix for each DMA. You know, this country is actually very heterogeneous. And each DMA, actually, the demographic mix is very different. And the search interests, you know, in terms of the mix, is actually very different. So we could actually correlate the search for that movie with these sort of search interests. And we can find out what kind of people are interested in this kind of film, what they're interested in as well. So we could do the positive and negative correlations. And right away, you can see that the positively correlated categories are like Christianity, hair care, weight loss, African American, and hip hop, family, debt management. You know, so these things, you know, you can kind of ideal. You know, you can sort of just picture, envision what kind of people they are who are interested in this kind of film. You know, this is what we call it, in marketing. We call it the portraits, right? We can draw a portrait about these people, and who are these? For the people who are not interested in these kind of films, in the negative side, you know, the people who are into bicycles, probably from Portland, yoga. Investment, Buddhism, beer, these are the type of people seem not to want to see this film. So this is a mental portraits or interest portraits of the other category of people who won't go see this film. So anyway, this is a little nifty study based on search trends. And not only do I just try the films, you know, I'm not a big K-pop fan, but I just originally assumed, like, you know, maybe the California Asians will be into K-pop. That's just my stereotype. What I did here is, like, I found this pretty well-known K-pop band called Blackpink, and I basically animated the search interest from 2016 to 2009 and animated and see how search trends, you know, where they're focused, where they're specialized, and then how it spreads across the country, right? Obviously, yeah, it's kind of starting from California, but really spread over entire country, and even the, like, Midwest and some South and Southwest, there are many DMAs actually also interested in this band. So apparently this band has quite a cross appeal. This is very surprising to me as well. It's a K-pop band, yeah. So what I've shown you so far is just, like, how we can get consumer insights for the trends data. This time I'm not going to switch the gear, and, you know, it's my favorite thing, you know, because machine learning, AI is like really popular these days. So, like, 2 years ago, I decided to use this as my 20% project. Just maybe I can use Google Query Trends to predict the box office, you know, opening weekend. What can I do better than, you know, these critics or LA Times or whoever there are out there, right? So that was my fun project. And question is like, well, not only can we use this to predict the box office, right? There's other entertainment products out there. Maybe we can use, you know, Google Trends or even trailer views to gouge consumer interest before the releases and predict other things such as TV viewership of your, you know, seasonal episodes and video game sales and also concert ticket sales, right? These are pretty interesting questions out there, and people want to match the supply with the demand ahead of time, and knowing the getting a really good prediction really going to optimize or make your industry a lot more sufficient. So, anyway, so that was, I'm just going to opening, I think there's a lot of things you can do out of there. I'm just going to showcase the first project I did. So how I did it, you know, this engine has been running actually for 2 years now. You know, I gave this engine actually, I passed it over to our entertainment pod. And so the way I did it actually is actually figure out what features, what signals are very important. And I run a whole bunch of machine learning methods and pick out the best ones and combine them. And that gives us the best prediction. So I discovered that the most important thing to get the best predictions is two things. Is one, data quality. Second thing, features. What features are important? What features are not? You know, you had to re-engineer and add features in the process, and each step would give you better accuracy. So the features I actually use, we have like Google Search Trends, YouTube Search Trends, and also we have a YouTube trailer views. It seems very simple here, but actually I spent a lot of time just trying to figure out what kind of trailer views are important, you know, what time of period, and because every time a studio releases a trailer, it gets duplicated by many other channels, and also they have a different length. Some views are paid, some views are organic, and also they actually drop several trailers over the time, right? So there's a lot of noises around these signals, and you had to figure out what signal is really important. And also add a few other things like number of theaters, rating, genre, studio types. We have many different studios from Disney to very small ones. Is there a sequel? Is that franchise? And then what I discovered, actually, the theme I call like, is that film a kid's film, a musical, or actually African-American films? These themes actually all have very interesting prediction powers. And the other features I kind of added was like, is that released at a holiday? Is a special day? Maybe it's like a horror film for Halloween or romantic comedy for Valentine. You know, these timing across the genre actually also have some impact. It's a time of a year or number of there's a very big film released this day. You know, like there's an Avenger this week. Is that going to affect the other releases? And maybe there's another big blockbuster in the last week. So all these features, I just throw them into the prediction engine and let the engine decide which features are important. So the type of methods I use is like a whole bunch of them, right? There's so many machine learning methods out there, but the primary ones I really think is very good is like random forest, XGBoost, and rule fit. Of course, NeuralNet was part of AI thing, and NeuralNet didn't do a very good job here. But there's a big challenge here is that because our training data set here is very tiny, right? Most of the time, when we talk about deep learning, we have millions of training records. Here, I have like 500. So a lot of these sort of deep learning, whatever, just doesn't work here at all. And also how to sort of combine different models. So the current trend is like everybody's doing ensemble, right? You combine different methods together to get the best results. It's not just one method. It has to be a bunch of them. And so I discovered, like, of course, everything's kind of intuitive. You know, accuracy increases significantly in the final week before the release. But accuracy actually is kind of flat between 1.5 month and 3 month. You know, so you can pretty much do the same job, but then when it gets closer to release date, the prediction accuracy increases dramatically. And, of course, different methods have different accuracy as well. We're just going to handpick the best one. This is actually what we call importance chart for random forest. I'm going to go skip that. But basically, this method will tell you what features are important, what features are not important. And I think this is actually have intuitive and also other meanings, you know, business meanings behind it as well. What I want to point out actually is Rotten Tomatoes score. So I actually use the Rotten Tomatoes score when it's available, which is only like the week before the release. And I really want to find out, it actually, does it make the prediction better or not? So I train the model up to 2018, and I found that Rotten Tomatoes score is actually very significant. And I also was able to derive its significance by the score intervals, you know, from 0 to 100, what's the impact it is. And it turned out the relationship is not linear. You know, before 50, it's kind of similar. You know, whether it's a 45 or 20, it's not that important. Yeah. But once it goes to 60, 70, 80, it actually adds box office to the movie. You know, especially the higher it gets, the more you get. If you use the zero as a baseline, you know, if it's 90, it actually adds almost like a 40% of box office to the opening weekend. So it's very significant. But interestingly enough, this weekend I retrained this model using the latest data, like whole last year's 2019 data. And this variable all of a sudden, you know, became much less important this year. I haven't figured out why yet, but all I'm saying is things are evolving and changing. What you discover in the past might not update today. For some reason, I feel like the films released last year have a lot of sort of just a little different from previous year. I don't know if it's because Marvel films just do so well, distort the model a little bit or whatever. I haven't figured out yet, but my lesson is like, you know, you have to keep update the model and rediscover some new intuitions, yeah. So that's my topic about prediction. But as economists, you know, what I'm most interested in actually is not predictions, it's causal inference. You know, what I'm interested in is like, if you adopt a strategy, if you do thing A and B, is that effective or not? You know, is that gonna lead something positive? So that's what we call causal inference. You know, that's exactly what most econometricians do. And econometricians have a few tricks. The tricks like instrument variable, regression discontinuity, there's all these methods developed the last century, you know, enabling people to do that. And that's also, we think, that's what economists, you know, what we can bring to the table, that's different from traditional data scientists or statisticians, because we are really trying to focus on being rigorous about causal, you know. It's not just say, hey, I think this is gonna help us, you know. We wanna know why and how and quantify that help. But in terms of understanding causal inference, right, we talk about, like, say, drug tests. The common method is randomized control and experiment, right? This is very common in the pharmaceutical industry, not so common in the business before, but within the last 10 years, especially for tech firms, running randomized experiments, you know, has become almost like a very common practice. But for the traditional business like entertainment, I actually don't know how common this practice is. But we want to sort of, as economists, you know, we want to be an evangelist, you know, for this methodology, or this framework, to really make scientific sort of judgment about all the actions you take. But randomized experiments, it's not that easy to run because sometimes it's expensive, sometimes it's impossible. So what we want to do is like what we can get around. Do something called what we call a natural experiment. So today I'm actually going to give you two examples, right? One is actually what we call geo-experiments. It's a proxy for randomized experiments. The second one is a showcase about how we creatively find a natural experiment to discover like how effective advertising is for the movies. So how many people here actually heard about geo-experiments or have done geo-experiments in your business? I saw two or three. So it's a very uncommon practice, yeah. But Google has been actually trying to, at least, you know, we're trying to convince our clients to run geo experiments more often, because this is really a better way to really find out, you know, whether your strategy, your advertising is effective or not, and how effective it is. So geo experiment. Basically, what it means is like, you know, we have, say, for the U.S., we have 210 DMAs or like 52 states. Is that possible we randomly choose half of them as experiment and the other half as a control group, and then we do the comparison afterwards and find out whether, you know, you'll have a large advertising campaign, is it effective or not? So this process sounds simple, but it actually involves a lot of design, implementation, and the post-implementation analysis. So it's actually pretty tricky sometimes, because the data can be really noisy, the operation itself can be really problematic, and the data itself, in the end, you can't really find anything. As example, you know, we have certain rules you want to do. So first, you really want to choose non-overlapping regions, and you want to have consistent serving methods. And hopefully, you know, when you have your pairing control experiment, they should have a similar population or similar sort of query counts. And you also want to minimize the contamination between the regions, because, you know, one person in the one region might cross to the other region, and this person might get contaminated in terms of treatment. And also, we really want to match sort of pre-treatment sort of, you know, metrics such as trends, and then figure out the statistics. This is actually an example I pulled. This is one of the movies, you know, the transform movies. We have this transform many different states. What I did, I designed a method to split, you know, 52 states into two buckets. One is the what I call experiment. One is like control. So, you know, as a movie trends go, right, it goes up and go down and then go up before the release date. So I actually just, this is actually simulation data. I used these DMA trends. And then what I did, I randomly simulated. Maybe I have an advertising offline campaign. Maybe it has like 10% or 20% random sort of lift for that particular set of regions. And then I got another set of trends. And then I run this R package called causal impact. And the causal impact was able to sort of calculate the impact lift, which is like 10 to 20% after your launch. So this is basically half-baked sort of a study using real data and simulated data to illustrate that, you know, how this method can work to help you to understand, you know, your campaign actually created at least 10% lift for like Google Trends. But, you know, as we saw from the last part, like Google Trends is a really good predictor to your box office. Maybe this campaign will create 10% box office release, and then you can do all these ROI calculation to find out whether this is, you know, worth it or not, right? So just the one methodology I want people to think about. And of course, it's not that easy to run, as I always know that running experiments actually is very expensive, especially these kind of experiments. For most tech firms like Google or Facebook, you know, running experiments for your website is very, very easy. You know, you just turn a key and you can show different fonts, different pictures, different layout. It's very easy to run. But, you know, running experiments on advertising is much harder, right? Because there's a lot of operation involved. But still, like, a lot of companies are doing that. When we don't run these kind of randomized experiments, so our idea is actually, we actually want to look for what we call natural experiment. A natural experiment, what is that? It's an event where exposures are randomly boosted in some cities, but not the others. This is an experiment you're not intended to do, but somehow really happened. And economists is actually really good at finding them. If you look at all the papers in the last like few decades, you know, a lot of papers from economists about education, about healthcare, a lot of this is actually, it's about economists looking for these kind of natural experiments and understand the effect, the policy. So we're applying same methodology to the ads. And what would be this event be? So it turned out the Super Bowl is one of them. Why is Super Bowl one of them? Using Super Bowl fans, what we call Super Bowl fans can be an instrument. What does that mean? Because in the Super Bowl, right, there's two winning teams competing. And what happens for these winning teams, there's a lot more fans going to see this game than the cities that were not competing. So there's a difference right now from the exposures from average cities versus the cities are competing the game. So there's this difference. We can use that difference to parse out the effect of the exposure to the Super Bowl, because Super Bowl also always have a lot of trailer, you know, like advertising. And so the competing city actually have 10, 20% more ad exposures. Maybe we can correlate that additional ad exposures to the box office of that city and discover whether the Super Bowl ads is effective or not and how much incremental value is creating. So this paper actually was written 4 years ago by my boss, Hal Varian, chief economist, and one of my colleagues, Seth. He actually left Google a couple years ago, wrote this bestseller called Everybody Lies. If you want to read that book, it's a fantastic book. A lot of it is about like what I'm talking about, plus Google Trends parsing out all the social science topics. And the third author actually is Michael Smith from University of Carnegie Mellon. Anyway, so in this paper, what they did was like they collect all the data from 10 Super Bowl games and use Google Trends on opening weekend box office, and then did this two-stage instrument variable model to estimate how effective the Super Bowl ads is. So definitely, this is hard to read, but basically what they discovered is that it's a back-of-the-envelope calculation in the paper. Basically, if you show ads in the Super Bowl for the movie trailers, you get actually 20%, 21% ticket sales boost in the opening weekend. And then we can do the back envelope sort of ROI calculation, because the average opening weekend revenue at that time, this is a couple years ago, it's about $40 million. And Super Bowl slot costs $3 million. And if we assume 40, 50% it goes to studio, the ROI actually is 1.4 to 1. It's actually really a profitable business, you know, by showing these movies on the Super Bowl. It's just a very clever trick to do the estimate. But they also did a lot of robustness tests. What they do is like they run placebo movies, you know, like use the similar films that weren't advertised in the Super Bowl, and also use like runner-ups, like teams that just missed qualifying for Super Bowl. And in these both cases, they did not discover this ticket sales increase at all. So this sort of cross-validate that this method is actually very is accurate. So that's my second story about cost inference. I have a third one here because I always want to talk about it because they call me the weatherman of Google. The reason is because like this is back 2007. I kind of discovered that whenever there's a heat wave in Europe, you know, our performance in Europe just really bad, right? So I realized the movies that weather actually affects people's like behavior, search behavior, or whether they're using computer or tablet or not. So why is that? Because weather determines whether you want to go out or not. You know, it's a beautiful weather, you want to go out. If it's not good, you stay indoor. And in LA, you have an eternal sunshine, so you probably don't realize that. But if you live in Germany or Netherlands, this is probably, you're keenly aware of how weather is going to affect your mood and your behavior. So not only that, weather also creates sort of additional demand sometimes, right? If you're a skier, you know, the snow, you ski more, search for ski-related queries. If it snows, you know, you might buy more snow tile. So weather have this interesting cross sort of impact. But its impact has turned out to be much more nuanced than you originally expected. Like, the question is, like, thrown to me, is like, how do you prove that? You know, how do you quantify weather's impact on this business, right? And this is actually has been my interview questions for incoming data scientists for Google. And a lot of them couldn't even answer that very quickly. And it turned out, if you're math people here, it's actually a very simple way to do it. The simple trick is actually you do a sort of week over week difference calculation. You know, you compare today versus last Thursday, and then you compare today's temperature versus last Thursday's temperature. You do the scatter plot and you divide them into 12 months, and then you find out is there any pattern between these points or not. And one other thing I kind of hypothesized is like weekend behavior is very different with weekdays. So I color the weekend dots as red and weekdays as black, and then I can figure out, wow, yeah, it's right there. You know, what happened from spring all the way to September, you know, when temperature increases, people actually don't search. Yeah, it's very clear, but during the winter, and it doesn't matter. So, because it's cold, people are going to stay indoor no matter what. So, very simple math, and it gives you a very quick quantification model. And so, I did this for, say, Netherlands. You know, I want to use Netherlands as example because the weather is very sort of homogeneous. It's a small country. And so, question is, like, there's a heat wave in the middle of the May. Are people going to go see a movie or not? No, they don't. Europeans, you know, any sun they get, they want to be exposed, they will be out. It turned out in Netherlands in the May, when there was a heat wave in 2014, movies, actually, the queries lost almost 15% because they all going to be, you know, in the bar or outdoor drinking or whatever. You know, they're not going to theaters. Right? All these other verticals all got affected, too, because people don't want to search. People don't want to make business decisions. You know, like, they're not going to do travel, hotel, wedding planning. But what's really increasing there, right? Water sports increased. And these other essentials actually did not get affected that much, like pharmacy, pest control. These are more essentials. They don't get affected by weather nearly as much. So there's a lot of behavior pattern you can see right away, whether it's impact's not homogeneous. What about, is that case in US? My question is, but some people are like, well, if I'm in DC, you know, I'm in San Francisco, it never gets that hot. But in DC in July and August, it could be scorching hot. You know, you might just want to go to see the movie because there's AC, it's more pleasant. So once again, I took the data from DC. This is a Google Trends for movies. And I find out in July, August, there's no impact. No impact. Actually, it's a little positive. People actually might go back to see the movies. It's a very different behavior. Anyway, I'm reaching the end of my conversation here. Basically, I'm just showcasing, you know, a public data source and how much you can do with that. So it needs some creativity, intelligence to get insights. And you want to use the data to make the decision instead of just use your gut feeling. Thank you.
Thank you, Ching. Fantastic. Great way to start the show.